Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How close is the U.S. economy to recovery, and why has Texas fared better even through tough times than many other U.S. states? As of this morning, the Dow Jones Industrial Average seems solidly above the 12,000 mark and rising. The national unemployment rate dropped last month to about 9%, and U.S. productivity rose 2.6% in the fourth quarter of 2010. At the same time, prices of some raw materials are on the rise, housing prices in much of the country remain depressed, and mortgage foreclosures continue. So what can we expect for the remainder of 2011 and beyond? Joining us to talk about the overall and regional economic forecast is Richard Fisher. He is president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank in Dallas, and this year a voting member of the Federal Open Market Committee. Richard, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Is the economy's most pressing problem right now still unemployment?
It is. We lost millions of jobs during the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. We also had new people come into the workforce, so it's a big task. And jobs have been created since the recovery started, which was at the end of the second quarter of 2009, about a million jobs have been created, just far insufficient to the needs of the amount of jobs we need to create here in America for American workers, and that's the tough task.
Is it safe to say that we have avoided a double-dip recession? Can we stop worrying about that possibility?
I think we have. I think we have enough forward momentum. As one of my colleagues, one of my friends, Herb Kelleher, who everybody knows here in Dallas, the founder of Southwest Airlines, says we're cruising forward at 3 knots, not 30, but at least it's forward momentum. So I think the risk of a double-dip recession has receded in the rearview mirror, as has the risk of deflation.
Mm-hmm. What about the risk of inflation? This is something that you've worried about in the past.
Well, I'm known as a hawk. Now, part of that is because I don't want to be a dove, because a dove's a member of the pigeon family, and I don't want to be anybody's pigeon. But I'm very worried about it, generally speaking. Now, right now, we do not have significant inflationary pressures for the broad market basket of goods and services that you and I would consume. Mm-hmm. But we are seeing, as you point out in your introduction, very high prices for commodities and inputs that come into corporations, particularly those that are imported from abroad. That has to do with this new demand we have from all these new mouths and people we need to feed around the world, China, India, and all these people have come into the capitalist system. That's the good news. The bad news is they're driving up the cost. And then a little financial speculation is adding to the cost of these commodities. So the answer to your question is, as of yet, we haven't seen it feed into the general price chain in America. It does hurt in the pocketbook at the grocery store and at the gas station. But as far as the broad basket is concerned, we don't see inflation right now. We have an awful lot of slack in our economy here because we have so many unemployed workers. Mm-hmm. And usually to have inflation really take grip, you have to be fully employed or close to fully employed, and we're definitely not there yet. But I'm watching it very carefully, and we are watching it very carefully, quite wary about it.
Is it reasonable to be more worried about rising inflation than about stagnant unemployment figures?
This is an odd thing about our central bank, the Federal Reserve. We're the only central bank in the world that has what's known as a dual mandate. We are charged by Congress with creating monetary conditions to create full employment and yet not allow inflation to take grip, so to maintain price stability, and moderate interest rates. Well, sometimes you can't do everything at once. I am of the view that the greatest job destroyer of all and the greatest force that can create bad business decisions is inflation. So we must keep inflation under control. If I had my druthers, I would only have one mandate. It would be inflation control. And the reason for that is because the employment mandate is a very slippery political slope. And there are limits to what the Federal Reserve can do. We can float the boats by adding to the liquidity in the system. We've done an awful lot, as you know, recently. Cut interest rates to nil. No one's complaining about access to capital anymore, whether they're large or small businesses. Money is abundant. Excess bank reserves exceed $1 trillion. Corporations have more cash on their balance sheets than any time in history. So I think we've done our part. But there's also is the fiscal policy aspect and the regulatory policy aspect, and that's in the hands of the Congress of the United States.
And that's what businesses are worried about right now?
They're worried about final demand, whether or not they'll have demand for sales. Mm-hmm. But we are a consumption-driven society. You can't have growth in sales or growth in final demand unless you have growth in employment, unless you have more jobs. You can't have more jobs unless you have the means to do that. We provide the monetary means. And you have the incentive to hire American workers in a world, by the way, where you can invest your money anywhere you want to. to get your return on investment. And that incentive is derived from the tax regime, the regulatory regime, and a general attitude. And I hear an awful lot of businesses complaining still, in fact, quite vociferously, that these are discouraging to them committing capital here. And when you hire someone, you commit capital. You want someone to be there for a long term. You want to train them and so on, as opposed to the incentives and tax regimes they're getting from our competitors. So I like to say we've gone from a period before the Cold War of mutually assured destruction to now mutually assured competition. And we're going to have to figure out new ways to do it. And that's in the hands of the fiscal authorities, not in the monetary authorities, which I represent.
So let's talk about that. What could Congress be doing right now that it is not doing, in your opinion?
Well, first of all, I'm not elected by the American people. I'm head of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas.
You're not even appointed by the president. You're appointed by the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas here.
Thank God. No, that's very important because we have a dual system. The governor, Board of Governors, Chairman Bernanke chairs the Board of Governors,
right.
Also chairs the Open Market Committee. But he and his colleagues, of which there are usually seven, there are only six right now. We don't have seven because the Congress decided in their wisdom that the man who won the Nobel Prize for Economics last year didn't know enough macroeconomics, but that's a separate subject. They're appointed by the president, approved by the Senate, just as I was when I was an ambassador. The 12 bank presidents are selected from their own board of directors, consist of nine people. Herb Kelleher is currently the chairman of my board. And that ranges from Herb to a man named Joe Jim King, who's a goat farmer in Brady, Texas, who is CEO of a $60 million bank. I said million, not billion, a small community bank. I choose at their service, at their pleasure. I represent 27 million people in my district that cover 630,000 square miles. And just to get to Texas for a second, that outproduces Australia and almost produces as much as India. So we have a big, powerful machine here. My job is to take the views of what I can discern from that population base and represent them at the table of the Open Market Committee in the best interest of the United States. And, of course, I think what we do here in Texas is in the best interest of the United States. So that's sort of the structure that we have. There are 12 Federal Reserve banks. Those bank presidents run a business. I'm CEO of a $100 billion bank. We lend money to all the banks in our district for their working capital needs. We supervise and regulate banks. And things that you probably don't think about, the folding money in your pocket or in your pocketbook, cash, is a Federal Reserve note. So we order that folding money according to the needs that we perceive in our district in order so that people can spend, have money in their pocket. And in the old days, we also cleared checks and so on, but those are now electronically processed. So we perform a myriad of service for the 27 million people in our district and for the people of the United States.
So that's what the Federal Reserve does. What is Congress not doing, to go back to the question?
Well, I was trying to avoid your question because I'm not a congressperson. And they are going to have to do a very difficult thing. They're going to have to provide the incentives for businesses to take the liquidity we have put in the system and put it to work in hiring American workers and investing in America. In a world in which they have a choice, and in fact, if they're publicly held or privately held, they have a duty to their shareholders to invest it in the most advantageous way to earn a return on that investment. Mm-hmm. And they can choose the whole world right now. So Congress is going to have to refashion their tax incentives and their regulatory incentives and the other things that they do to incent American business to hire American workers. And we have a lot of people we have to put to work, millions upon millions. And yet they're going to have to do it in a way that addresses the issue of the undermined confidence that people have that they'll solve our long-term fiscal sinkhole that both Republicans and Democrats have created over generations of Congress. So they have to incent businesses to hire, but do it in a way that doesn't dig a deeper hole of these fiscal deficits and our unfunded liabilities, which now are so large they're almost hard to believe. They have really dug a sinkhole that will bury the economic future of my children, my grandchildren, and their children.
Is the United States
a tough task for these people to do? But these are the people we elect. We have a new Congress. I think and I hope and I pray that they mean business, and they're just going to have to go about it. But this isn't what the central bank does. It's what our Congress people do, working with the president.
Is the United States in any danger of losing its credit rating?
Well, unless we get our act together, eventually that'll happen. We are the prima inter pares of all economies in the world. We're $13 trillion in output. We are the richest country in the world. We're an example to the rest. Money comes here out of safe haven. You noticed recently when Europe had its problems, we had flows here. Whenever there's a problem in Egypt, we see flows to the United States Treasury credits. And that will only happen as long as we can demonstrate to the rest of the world that we can bring our own accounts under control. Japan has been downgraded. Other countries have been downgraded. It can happen, and it's all of our jobs, whether we're monetary or we're on the fiscal side, to work hard to make sure that does not happen.
Richard Fisher is my guest. He's president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. We're talking about the economic outlook for 2011 in the United States and specifically in Texas. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Jeff Whittington is in now, senior producer of Think and host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. What a great conversation. And thank you very much, Mr. Fisher, for being our guest today and for your patience during this membership campaign. We had hoped, Chris, to wrap the drive up by now so we could have a full hour. But you know what? This is very important that we raise the money necessary to continue to bring you conversations like the one you're hearing today right here on KERA, available to everyone in the North Texas area, everyone really who listens, who lives in this area, has a stake in this program, in this conversation. And you know, it's your opportunity today to do your part. I do want to thank Edward Searcy in Coppell and Barry Whistler in Dallas. Hey, Barry, thank you so much for your contribution. Only $210,189 left to raise, and the drive will end.
We know that you are as eager for this moment to come as we are. We are not ashamed to be asking you for money because this is how we operate. However, we all like to be doing our jobs full time, and fundraising doesn't exactly take away from things, but it takes away a little of the time we have to spend talking about the things that you care about. It's really important to us that we serve you, which is different in some ways than some other broadcasters. Our main client is you. You're the ones who give us the money that we need to keep the station operating. Our main client is not advertisers. We do get some underwriting money, but it's structured in a slightly different way than a lot of commercial broadcasters. We come to you directly because we want to be accountable to you. You can make this possible, and you can help support this station by calling 1-888-694-6931. You can also go online to kera.org, which is a great place to check out thank you gifts if there's something that you thought you really wanted to have in order to complement your membership to KERA. We do have a bunch of options, and you can check them out easily online.
Online at kera.org. You can make your safe and secure contribution there. Your dollars go to work right away when you use your credit or debit card to support the station. It just takes a couple of minutes. You fill out the membership form with your name, your address, your, you know, how we can get in touch with you, which credit card you want to use, or you can ask for an invoice to be sent, and we'll do that, and you can send a personal check, or you can become a sustaining member and set up a monthly transfer from your account to KERA's account. It's all up to you, but you can make all those choices online at kera.org. You can call 888-694-6931. Talk to a nice person who will walk you through the easy membership process. And of course, you've already decided to listen to the station. So we're just hoping that today that we can motivate you to go ahead and make that call, make that contribution online and become a contributing listener to the station, because that's how we raise almost 60% of the budget here. 58% of our annual budget at KERA comes directly from your contributions.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. We have a pretty amazing offer if you like Ken Burns documentaries. At the $275 level, if you can receive, I believe it's all, is this all three, Jeff?
It is.
You can receive the entire Civil War series, which I think is five DVDs, the entire National Park series, which is six, and the entire baseball series, updated with the one that came out last fall. That's 11 DVDs. You get all of them when you make a contribution at or above the $275 level. You can do this immediately online at kera.org, or you can pick up the phone and call 1-888-694-6931. Thanks to Timothy Seltzer in Plano, Jessica Hoffman in Prosper, and Barbara Liga in Fort Worth. We'll be back in a minute with Richard Fisher.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Richard Fisher. He is president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. It was widely speculated that you would not vote to continue the bond program, the bond buying program, through June of this year. Can you talk about why you voted for it in the end?
First, I've made it very clear I would not have voted for it in the first place had I been a voting member. And I actually, since all of us sit at the table, the voting matter is a formality, but all participate in the discussion. That is the 12 bankers plus the seven governors, now six governors. I argued against it. But the majority of the committee approved it. I wasn't alone in arguing against it. Mr. Honick of Kansas City had the vote. He was against it. There were some others. But the majority of the committee, and the committee makes a decision as a group in its wisdom, that program is underway. I think it's a fait accompli. I cannot envision a scenario going forward, given the way the economy is unfolding here, where I could possibly support any further monetary accommodation beyond that program. And in fact, I would veto, or not veto, I would, let me strike that word from this discussion, I would formally dissent as a voter if we wanted to put into place a new program on top of that. I do think, however, this business of dissenters and so on, it's not a, we don't have caustic arguments. Mm-hmm. These are responsible people who sit down and do their level best to try to get it right. And I think the role of dissent is a healthy one because it demonstrates to the marketplace that there are different opinions at the table. But just so you know, whether you have a vote or not, you still have a voice at the table. We all participate in the discussion. And I've made it clear in my public pronouncements that I was not in favor of that program to begin with. And the reason for that is because I think we have sufficient liquidity in the system now. I think the Fed's done a very good job. We did pull the economy back from the brink. We would have had a depression worse than the Great Depression when everything failed in 2008, 2009. We're central bankers. Our job is to be the lender of last resort. We did our job. And I hope your listeners know that we not only did our job, which is unusual in government, we closed those programs down when we were done, and we made $48 billion in 2009 and $78.4 billion for the American taxpayer last year, and we paid it back to the Treasury. So you're looking at a rare person, or listening in the case of radio, who works for a government agency that A, does what they say they're going to do, B, close them down when they're done, and C, actually makes money and doesn't increase the deficit but pays it down.
And in fact, the funding for the Fed doesn't come from the federal government initially, right?
No,
you earn all the money that...
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We operate without any federal government support. Of course, we have a unique franchise. But the point is, we don't take money from the taxpayer. We pay money back to the taxpayer.
What kind of ongoing contact do you have with your colleagues at the other Federal Reserve banks?
It's constant. In my case, it's more than constant because for the next 2 years, I'm chairman of the Conference of Federal Reserve Bank Presidents. There are 12 banks, as I mentioned earlier. We run significant operations, the payment system in the United States, the vaults that house all the cash, the education programs that we do for the American people. The supervision and regulation of banks in the field is done by the Federal Reserve banks. And then, of course, very importantly, our lending operations. We lend money to other banks, little community banks in places like Brady and other parts of Texas to keep their working capital working overnight. And we all 12 get together and talk about and constantly are working on the operations of the Federal Reserve System, the kind of things that the American people take for granted but are necessary to keep the economy performing and to keep our banking system in place. And as far as policy is concerned, we have constant discussions, but we usually save our policy pronouncements either for our public speeches or when we sit at the table at the Federal Open Market Committee.
So your authority extends across Texas and also to part of southern New Mexico and part of Louisiana. Is that correct?
The productive parts of Louisiana.
Well,
I love Louisiana, and we have part of Louisiana and the southern part of New Mexico.
Talk about why Texas has done better in this recession. You've described it in the past as a very business-friendly environment.
Yeah, this is actually a very important point because when you think about it in terms of the role of monetary policy, U.S. monetary policy affects every state the same way. Mm-hmm. The cost of capital in Ohio or New York or California or pick another state is the same as it is here. The cost of a mortgage is the same as it is here. So what differentiates the performance between the states? Answer, fiscal and regulatory policy. And I'm just going to reel off some statistics here, but we added 700,000 jobs in Texas over the last decade. California lost 600,000. The population of Ohio grew by only 183,000 residents over the last decade. We grow by that amount every 5.5 months. Hmm. As you know, California lost or did not gain a seat in the last census. New York lost seats. We picked up 4. And if you look at the Federal Reserve District that I'm lucky to be the head of, and you were to go back 20 years, the rate of growth of employment in my district is outperformed all the rest. So something unusual is happening here. And I think what is happening here, since we all have the same monetary policy within the United States, is obviously the difference between the way business is taxed, regulated, and the incentives that people get to create jobs. That makes us more attractive. And I think there's a lesson there for how we operate in the rest of the world. Right now, in the old days, we were more of an island, and we only had a few competitors. You had Germany and you had England, and China was closed because of communism. No one wanted to be Russia because of communism, et cetera. Now the whole world is the playing field. This is good news. We won the Cold War. That's the good stuff. But again, now we have competition, and just as money can and people and capital and jobs can flow from Ohio or New York or California to Texas, money can flow and jobs can flow from the United States to India or Estonia or Vietnam or China. And this makes making all these new laws and new rules and regulations even more difficult than it was before. But I don't think monetary policy is the answer. We've done our job. Now the issue is up to the elected representatives of the people.
I mentioned in the introduction that there was, a 2.6% increase in U.S. worker productivity in the final quarter of 2010. Are there pros and cons to a number like that?
Well, we want a productive workforce. The question is, how do you get it? By working less hours and working more? American businesses have become extremely efficient. They became started to work and turn it on when we had high rising inflation up to the summer of 2008 when the wheels came off the bus with Lehman's failure and so on, which I might add, we were not responsible for regulating. That was the SEC's watch. So when the economy ground to a halt, up to that point, we had inflation beginning to work its way through the system. What do you do if you're a woman that's running a company? You want to grow your bottom line, and if you can't price things aggressively to go out the door when things are coming in the door at much greater expense, you're going to bear down and run your business as efficiently as possible. These days, people are using enormous amount of IT and technology to ramp up the productivity of their workforce and drive down the cost of labor. That's what was happening when we had the inflationary scare of 2008. And then when everything stopped, final demand evaporated, we went into the risk of a deflationary mode because there was no final demand when the system ground to a halt in the Great Recession. Businesswomen and men even drove that even harder. So we have achieved enormous efficiency. We have an enormously muscular business sector, public and private. And now the question is, what will give them confidence to hire? Well, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to work their workers as to be as productive as possible to get to your question. Once they reach that point, the preference is to grow the top line, not just the bottom line, which is their net income figure, but to grow sales. And they're going to try to figure out a way to invest their money to enhance that possibility. Again, they can invest anywhere in the world. They can employ people anywhere in the world. They can sell anywhere in the world if they're good. And they'll go to where they're going to get the best return on that investment. So what we are hopeful for is that the right incentives will be given to do it here. The answer to your question is productivity is driving up in part because people and workers are being driven harder and they are harder working and they're also fearful of losing their jobs. So they produce more. It's good news and it's bad news. We still need more people in the workforce. We need to employ more Americans.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones and speak with Joshua in Denton.
Mr. Fisher.
Joshua.
Joshua.
Yes. Hi. Go ahead, please. You're on the air.
Oh, okay. Hi. I was actually calling. You were talking about the economy, Mr. Fisher, and what I'm actually starting with organizations that are working with communities, and what I really want to affect is the economy of small communities. So out of Denton right now is I'm trying to look at ways about improving just the general economic like stability of Denton and improving it to then move on to other communities. So my question is what your advice or just any type of knowledge you would have on working with microeconomics, I suppose. I don't have a degree or anything in economics, but working with microeconomics to then help with macroeconomics, because I kind of feel that in the pursuit of larger things, maybe smaller communities might get left out or behind, such as like small businesses in Denton might fall out due to large businesses working, you know, like dealing with just Texas instead, and just developing into that scale, like businesses in general.
Yeah, I think we've got it, Joshua. Any comments?
Well, Joshua, don't be shy about not knowing economics. I like to say I don't have, by the way, a PhD in economics either, because I was too hindered by common sense. So you've got common sense, and you're right. Many micros make a macro. I mean, you can't have a macroeconomy without microeconomies. So I wouldn't be shy about your question. I don't know that Denton itself, as well as I know other parts of our North Texas community, but I think what one has to do is, again, just provide an encouraging environment for people to locate there. That environment goes way beyond whatever you can do in terms of a regulatory environment. You can't do a whole lot in a city like Denton, and you're not going to have a different tax regime than you have elsewhere. It does go to things like your education, the quality of your schools. Why do people want to be there? What kind of things can they do to attract people to come? And I do think that education, in the end, is really what is the greatest magnet we could possibly have. In that case, unfortunately, Texas fares very, very poorly. And if you could work on that front alone, I think that would provide a great incentive for people to locate in Denton.
We have the lowest number of high school graduates in the country over the age.
50 out of 50.
Yeah.
Aren't you proud?
I am not proud.
Yeah.
Especially with four kids in the public school system.
Yeah. No, we need to do a great deal more there. And I hope, speaking of that our legislature, of course, has very tough decisions to make, but that they don't cut off their nose despite their face by damaging whatever education infrastructure we currently have. 75% of the state's budget goes to health or to education. We have a deficit. Something has to be done about it. I just hope they're thoughtful and don't damage our school systems and our university system, which is very important because that's what draws people in. If you stop and you get more tier one universities, are going to demand better education for their children, the people that come here to profess and to teach and to lead. And I think that is the biggest obstacle we have long term to staying the richest and most powerful state is our educational infrastructure. So in Denton, I'd turn it on the education front.
Richard Fisher is my guest. He is president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. We'll resume our conversation with him in a moment. You can join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We're going to take a couple of minutes out of this discussion to talk to you about supporting KERA. We're not talking about billions or even millions of dollars at this point. Jeff Whittington, we're down to needing $210,000 and some change. Is that right?
Yes, we could so quickly get past the psychological $200,000 barrier. And historically, Chris, and you know this, and many of our listeners know this, we've been able to raise, in the neighborhood of $150,000-ish in the last day of the drive. And, you know, because many of you wait for that sort of dramatic moment to get involved in the station's membership campaign, and that's fine. Well, the moment is almost here. And actually, it could be here.
Start the drama.
It could be here.
We need a little drama.
It could be here directly if you would go ahead and call 888-694-6931 or contribute online at kera.org. $209,674 left to raise in the overall $700,000 membership campaign. Your call right now to 888-694-6931 or your online gift at kera.org will help us get there.
Information is one of those things that we value on an increasing basis in this world, and we have decided as a society that it's worth paying for. We pay for things like cable television. We know how many of you are constantly at the bookstore and at films and you know, cultural events. This is just one more information source. The difference is that we don't sort of charge admission at the door. After you come in, sample and enjoy the product and say, yes, I'll be back every single day, we say to you, okay, decide what fits in your budget. You know, we know that for some of you, $35 a year might be what you can do. And for a lot of you, hundreds or even thousands of dollars are not outside the realm of what is responsible for your budget. It's all about making choices and about, you know, really funding the things that you value. But this is a nonprofit organization that you're already using. You're not only, you know, helping this organization, you're a beneficiary.
You've been walking around the bookstore for a while, reading the titles. enjoying
them. At some point, they give you the gimlet eye and the Barnes & Noble and, yeah. and you buy something.
And, in this world, it's just you and the station. It's you and whoever happens to be speaking on the air. If it's Terry Gross and the 11 a.m. hour, if it's Diane Rehm and her guests and the 9 or 10 a.m. hour, if it's Chris and her guests in the noon and 1 o'clock hour, Monday through Thursday, you're hanging out with these folks. And no one is saying, we know you've been listening, and well, we're saying it now, except that it's totally up to you. We understand if you're in a position where, as a student or someone who cannot contribute at this time, and you know what, that's okay, because public radio should be here available for everyone, because we bring you that diversity of opinions that you appreciate, and the really human conversational tone where everyone is treated with respect. But you know, someone has to actually help pay the bills. Someone actually has to step up and make a difference by calling 888-694-6931 or by contributing at kera.org.
It only takes a couple of minutes to make sure that your contribution, that your membership, rather, is current. You get on the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Or my favorite way, you go online to kera.org. And we now have, thanks to Alan Melson and our awesome folks in our communications department, little buttons so that if you're on Facebook or Twitter or a variety of other social media, you can let your friends know. And you're really a big influence on the people in your life who may think, well, nobody gives to that public radio station. We all listen and we all figure that someone else is giving, but I don't know anyone. Well, maybe your friends don't know that you're making a contribution, and you are, and you can influence them to take up the mantle.
Yeah, you have a powerful influence on the people in your life, just like they do with you. And, you know, if you just let people know that you're supporting KERA and ask them, hey, have you done your part? It would really go a long way to help us raise this final $209,674 exactly. To be able to meet our overall membership goal for this membership campaign.
I want somebody to call right now and be the 74. That's what I'd like, so we can have a nice round
74.
Number for now. Be the 74. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. We do have thank you gifts available. We know that you're not calling specifically for that, but sometimes some of us are programmed to want to get a thing in our hands if we've spent some money. If you want a thank you gift, you can look at them all on our website, kera.org.
Yeah, you can pick up the Think mug for your very own at the $60 membership level. There's a huge variety. Just check it out at kera.org or call 888-694-6931. Please, someone be the 74. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour, Richard Fisher. He is president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. You mentioned before the break, Richard, that you don't have a PhD in economics. One thing that always interests me is that you can have a PhD in economics, you can study everything, you can look at the rational bases for the things that we see happening, and then there's this sort of sketchy, psychological, emotional thing that plays into how human beings make decisions about their business and their money. How much do you have to try and understand that in crafting policy?
It's a judgmental business, and I think it's very, very important. I don't want to downgrade economists. I mean, but we are supported. We have the best economic research imaginable at the Federal Reserve System. We're the largest hirer of PhDs in economics, and I don't have one of them. Now, I was taught by a man named John Kenneth Galbraith at my college, and I must say I didn't agree with a lot of his economics, but he did have one line which was great, which he said, economic forecasting was invented to make astrology look respectable. So I think you have to keep things in. You can build all the economic models you want. I have an MBA, and I ran businesses, and I worked my way up. So I think it's very important to understand what impacts decision makers. And jobs are created by businesses, small businesses, large businesses, small businesses that feed into large businesses. What incents people to create a job? Obviously, the cost of capital is very important. If interest rates are way too high or the cost of our money's not available, that clamps down on your ability to operate. But, you know, what incents them? If you tax them to death, and I'm not suggesting that that is done, but if you obviously tax them at 100%, there's no incentive to take an extreme. And if you regulate them to the point where they have to spend all their time conforming with regulation and not actually worrying about selling a product or creating a service or whatever it may be, that's a disincentive. So I think common sense has to prevail in the end. And that's really what this comes down to. What I bring to the table is different than my colleagues. I've actually been in the real world. I've actually built businesses. I've actually run them. I've seen the government side as well. But I think it's very important. I've actually been a banker, unusual. But I think it's very important to understand what motivates people to do what made America great. And that is to grow prosperity. And the way you grow prosperity is you put people to work, productive work. And Chris, I would also add the only place where you get lasting job creation is the private sector. So I think it's very, very important that we succeed at that task. And again, I think the Federal Reserve, its main task, it should be to keep prices stable and keep financial markets stable so that businesswomen and men can go about the business of doing what they do, which is not worrying about accounting tricks and about how to keep up with inflation and how to deal with this or that, but rather just focus on creating jobs and growing their profits and growing prosperity.
When the Fed takes action, how do you monitor and measure the impact of what you've done as compared with a variety of other factors from the private sector, from legislation? How do you decide what's you?
Well, we can see it. We can see it in our balance sheet, first of all, which I should add is the only financial institution in the world, public or private, and the only government agency I know of, that posts its financial statement weekly on the net. People say, you're not transparent. We are providing our financial statement every single week on the net.
Who's accessing that financial statement on a weekly basis?
Anybody who wants to.
But I mean, do you have a sense of who wants that information that often?
Well, it's interesting. I think we need to track how many people are actually accessing it, but we're providing it and it's there so they can examine what we're doing. And you can, it's not just watching the expansion of our balance sheet or the money supply, M2, and all these monetary figures. That's what the M stands for, the money supply numbers. It's also doing constant surveying and constant modeling. We survey all the bank loan officers, for example. So we have an enormous amount of input, and this is where our economists just do an extraordinary job of collecting all this data, summarizing it for us, monitoring the markets, and we can see not just the direct result of what we do, but the psychological impact of what we do, not all of which is always positive, and if we notice that it's not very positive, then we have a duty to correct it or rein it in. It's a matter of just keeping track and having good people to do that. And I believe we have an extraordinary staff that is, by the way, extremely productive, to go to your point on productivity. But in the end, this is a judgment call. Mm-hmm. I know it is bothersome to many, many people that we don't have a commodity-based currency. By the way, the Swiss don't. The Europeans don't. The Japanese don't. The British don't. They don't exist anymore. And therefore, it puts a greater onus on us to make good judgments because ours is a faith-based currency. And it's based on the faith of two things. One is the monetary authority, which is the central bank, the Federal Reserve, to conduct themselves with integrity. And the other is for the underlying structure of our tax basis and the deficits that we have or the surpluses that we might conceivably run in order to conduct the business of our great nation in a way that inspires confidence. To me, that's what needs most correction right now. We need to restore that confidence by bringing our accounts into balance, funding our unfunded liabilities, reining in these deficits, and do so in a way that simultaneously incents businesses to hire people.
Let's go back to the phones now, 800-933-5372. We'll speak with Sarah in Dallas. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Warning, yes. I want to go back to the very beginning of the conversation interview when Mr. Fisher was defining the difference between what the Reserve Bank does in monetary policy and then the question of the Congress doing fiscal policy. Mm-hmm. And his statement that, you know, right now corporations are generally have become flush with profits again, and money is available, et cetera, et cetera. What if the Congress, the government, decided that making money available to American corporations, now this is just theoretical, this is not my political position, whatever, but what if that was contingent upon that the money be reinvested in the United States so that jobs would be created in the United States.
Let's get an answer for it.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if that could be done, actually, because what you would be doing is saying no capital could flow out of the United States. My first guess would be that other countries then say, well, fine, then we're not going to bring any capital into the United States. And you realize that given the deficits that have been run and the amount of debt the U.S. Treasury, not the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Treasury has issued because of the deficits that Congress has built, a lot of the financing that buys into U.S. Treasuries comes from overseas. China's the largest single holder after the United States of U.S. Treasury debt. So I would imagine if we did that, there might be some retaliation. We don't live in a closed world anymore. We're not an island. Just as Texas is not an island and benefits or can not benefit from money and jobs going to another state. That's the way the world operates. We can't put that back in the can. So I don't think that's, with all due respect, very practicable. And I think it would probably frighten businesses more than assist their confidence.
The financial markets have been doing quite well over the past year or so. Is mm-hmm. is that growth at an appropriate rate as far as you can tell?
Well, I don't know what an appropriate rate is, but you're right. The stock market has rallied. The bond market, interest rates have not only come down, but credit spreads have narrowed, meaning that businesses that previously would have to spend more relative to what people could put into U.S. Treasuries now have access to capital at cheaper rates. And the theory behind that is that that will assist in elevating not only confidence but also purchasing power. The purchasing power of businesses to use the amount of capital that they have and the cheaper source of financing to commit to new capital expansion and to hire new people. And also those that are fortunate enough to have money invested in funds, and many, many Americans do, of some magnitude or another, will feel more comfortable and go out and spend again because they are wealthier. Even though I think a lot have been sort of chastised by their recent experience, they're going to be much more cautious than they have. It takes a long time for that fear to wear off. So that's the good news. The financial markets have a better tone. They have rallied. The cost of capital and the cost of financing, the cost of issuing equity has gone down. That gives businesses and those that hire people more to work with. And hopefully they'll put it to work. And that's beginning. But we still have a long way to go.
What do you see as the most significant threat to the ongoing recovery?
I think it's the not being a sufficiently rapid. It's a sort of a slow haul right now. It is gathering some steam. Back when we were in the Great Recession, my own forecast was it would be something like the Nike swoosh. You know, it's sort of a deep down and then come up, but it also be sort of flattened out on the long end of the swoosh, the long end of the curve, the check mark. And I think that's what we're seeing. It takes a while to rebuild confidence. People really were frightened by what they saw. And no business person I know wants to just hire people with the thought they're going to lay them off if they don't work out.
Yeah,
it's a very serious decision. And in order to have the confidence to do that, they have to have confidence in the future. And that confidence is growing, but it's still weak. And again, they have alternatives. That very nice lady that called in, Sarah, the world just doesn't work that way, unfortunately. And they do have alternatives. And so we have to compete by providing conditions that induce American business women and men to hire their co-Americans and put them back to work here. Create programs for them to do so.
Richard Fisher is president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. You can learn more at dallasfed.org. Richard, thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And thank you for doing what you do.
No problem. Thank you all for listening this hour. We really appreciate your participation in the show. We also appreciate those of you who have participated financially in the health of this station by going online to kera.org and by calling 1-888-694-6931 to make a contribution. Again, it is Jeff and I were sort of laughing before that it's funny to be sitting across from someone who deals with billions upon billions of dollars and talking about a couple hundred thousand dollars. For us, our reality is that this is a very big deal, and your contribution of of, you know, if you take that down to your level of $50 or $100 or $200 is a big deal to you. We totally understand that. But we ask that you seriously consider it. If you love public radio, if you listen every day, if you have chosen KERA, whether you live in North Texas or anywhere in the world and you listen online or on your mobile device, if you've chosen this as your public radio station, make a contribution.
Yeah, we just spent most of the hour with one of the few people in the world who can legally print U.S. currency. And
he doesn't get to take it home with him or anything.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't. But we're asking you to share a little bit of that currency with the station that you choose to spend your time with, that you choose to listen to. And, you know, I want to thank Pat and Roy Rubens in Arlington, Matt Lockhart in Dallas, Jennifer and Jason Barnes in Dallas. They've all done their part to support this public radio station. And there's just $209,144 left to raise in the drive. And then the drive is over. And at the instant that that last dollar is raised that is contributed, hopefully by you, then the drive will end immediately. And no matter where we are, we'll go right back to the regular schedule. And, you know, we will have several months, a couple of months till our next spring membership campaign. And you'll know that you did your part for the station every single time you tune in.
I'm actually going to respectfully dissent with you, my esteemed colleague. I don't hope that you contribute the very last dollar. I'd like you to contribute maybe the next dollar that we receive. Somebody out there will be the last person to make that contribution, but your contribution right now really does get us much closer. And for those people who are absolute, you know, they just won't consider giving a contribution until we're in the last $50,000 or $10,000. I guess we have to wait for them. But if you could be persuaded and you could do it now, we would really appreciate it. Once it starts to snowball at this point, and if you can help with the snowball, help sort of push it. We've had, I know, enough snow over the past week or so. Mm-hmm. But if you can get the momentum going, and it's also an overused word around here, but it really does happen that way. 1-888-694-6931 is the number. You can also go to kera.org.
Of course, you can make the last contribution right now if you'll contribute $209,144. Again, that's $209,144. We'll spread the payments out
over 12 months.
Much more affordable monthly installments. We'll be happy to do that.
What is that on the we'll even sustainable come, membership,
you know,
plan?
I'll even come get I'll come and get the check from you if that makes it easier. Because honestly, the drive ends the minute we raise that last $209,144. So, you know, do your part right now. Go online to kera.org. Or call 888-694-6931. I think we're getting a calculation of what that would be. We're going to get in the sustaining membership.
Well, our team in the other room is really on top of it. It's it looks like 17,420
something
per month.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Well, you know what?
There's somebody out there somebody who could do
out,
it,
yeah. But you know, you get to decide what your share is. And if your share is a couple of $1,000s, that's fantastic. If it's time still for you to renew your friend's membership, you joined last year at the $1,500 membership level, and you could see clear to make that call today, 888-694-6931, or renew your friend's level membership, or maybe upgrade to a friend's level membership at kera.org. It would really go a long way. Once we get into that $200,000 mark, it's going to happen a lot faster. And your contribution right now, when you choose an amount that's right for you, you should know it really does add up. We're still here asking because many of you have not contributed during the drive. And you know what? Maybe you haven't been listening. Maybe you've been out of town. You just haven't had a chance. But I would urge you to please take a moment right now to make the call to 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org.
This is your source for NPR News, 90.1 KERA, Dallas-Fort Worth, Denton, 100.1 K261 CW, Tyler, 88.3 K202 DR, Wichita Falls, 99.3 K257 EV, Sherman, and wherever you listen, either over the radio airwaves, online, on your mobile device, the way to get in touch with us to make a contribution is kera.org or on the phones at 1-888-694-6931.
Just make the commitment to do something besides just listen. You know, when somebody asks you, hey, do you listen to KERA? Yeah, I'm just a listener. Well, be more than just a listener. Be someone who actually helps maintain the stability and the health of this public radio station. When you give just $35 or maybe $135 or maybe $300 to the station, you help ensure that in the next big international news-making event, like the Egypt protests over the last, now it's becoming weeks, so that you know that we're here to cover that for you. The next time we get the opportunity to talk to the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, will still be here and able to do that so that you can participate in that conversation and you can hear those kinds of insights about what's going on with the economy, what's going on here in North Texas. And it only costs whatever you think it's worth once a year. So please do your part.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can do this online at kera.org. Big thanks to Kyle and Jill Baggs in Flower Mound and Sunisa and Terry Griffin in Garland. Thanks to you. You have plenty of time to call now. We'll be starting the show after the news. We know that you'll appreciate listening to it, but right now we'd love to hear from you at kera.org or 1-888-694-6931. Thanks.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.